Testing. Yeah, you're fine now.
Okay, testing. Okay, welcome everyone to the course on sociocultural ethnography and ethics. We're going to have a full day of lectures today. And first of all, I want to thank all of the lecturers who voluntarily offered their time to lecture for this course. So thanks to all of you, and we were able to put the course together fairly quickly. This course is the first in a series of courses offered by the faculty. There will be one course each semester about methods. So various kinds of methods, not always qualitative like we have today, but there will be quantitative methods as well. Some of the courses will be in Finnish, some in English, and we will try to ensure that these courses also are available online for those who are not able to make it actually to the course to be physically present. So you can expect another course in spring, and in this way we're trying to then broaden our course offerings for our PhD students here at the Faculty of Humanities, and which will soon be the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences, starting in the 1st of January. Okay, so my name is Laura Stark. I'm the Vice Dean of the Faculty of Humanities, and I'm in charge of PhD studies. And so if you ever have any questions or concerns, you can email me. So today I'm basically just going to give a quite short introduction to just some basic concepts in ethnography and ethics. And I want to leave enough time for you to ask questions or make comments as you wish. So be thinking if you have any questions, and I'll be happy to answer those or comment on your comments, etc. Okay.
I
think I'll be. Thanks. Okay. Thanks, yeah. Yuka. Okay, actually, because I like to walk around when I talk and I have kind of a big booming voice, I think I'll maybe move away from the microphone at this point, and just let me know, Yuka, if you think, is it recording?
For the recording, I should use
the microphone.
You should either use this mic or that mic.
Or this one.
Yeah, okay.
And the video camera is located where, so that I can occasionally look?
It's the white ball.
White ball, excellent. Okay. Now, is that working? Can you hear that? Yeah. Okay, so now this font is a little small, I realize. And so I'll just go through this. So basically, what is sociocultural ethnography? And there are probably as many answers to that question as there are ethnographers. We can think of the ethnographic method as not one method, but as perhaps a family of related methods, and all sharing something in common. So the way that I define ethnographic method, based on my own experience, I've done interviews in Russia, I've done interviews in Tanzania, in Ethiopia, is that the ethnographic method involves interviews and some degree of physical presence and opportunity for observation in the place studied. What do I mean by some degree? Well, if you're interviewing people, let's say in a closed office, the people come, they get interviewed, and they go. That's not necessarily ethnography in my estimation, because you don't get a chance to see those people in their real everyday lives. Okay, for me, ethnography is some chance to spend time with people, to be with them in the places that are familiar to them, possibly in their homes, but not necessarily. What ethnography used to mean several decades ago was that you had to go and spend 2 or 3 years living with some small group somewhere, and then only then were you seen to be, for example, a real anthropologist. That's, first of all, no longer possible for most people simply due to the lack of money to do that. Lack of funding. Also, everything is so much more in a hurry. There's less time to go and spend that much time with a group. Some people still manage to do that, and that's wonderful. But for many of us, ethnography means short visits to places or spending time with people who live in the same general area or country where we're living. So it can be many things, but there needs to be some degree of being with people and seeing something of their ordinary lives or unordinary lives. Okay, and in addition, social cultural ethnography, in my view, is usually not the first method that a researcher would choose if they wanted to know what percentages of things is, you know, happening out there, or that they wanted facts, they wanted firm historical dates. Ethnography is maybe not the first choice in that sense. You might use historical documents, you might use surveys, questionnaires, okay? But there's lots and lots of things that we do want to study that are difficult to get at if we're using just questionnaires or surveys. And here I have a list of things that came to my mind. This is just, this is an incomplete list. There's plenty more things that we could add to this list, but things like people's beliefs, people's attitudes, motivations, what makes people do what they do, why do they do what they do, concepts, agency and power, when do people have power, how do they resist power, how do they get to be full social actors, okay, so that's agency and power, meanings of anything, symbolic meanings, meanings of a ritual or a discourse or various practices, and that brings us to practices themselves and the kinds of, especially the kind of daily practices that make our world seem real in the way that it seems, as often through the practices that we don't always even talk about. And those things are hard for people to reflect upon, and that's where this sort of participant observation, where we actually look at what people do and watch them doing it, that can be important. Then things like social networks and how people interact. And then finally, communication. This is where language comes in. Language, of course, being a very primary way in which we understand the world. So for all of these things, ethnography, where we spend time with people, we ask them questions, but we also let them talk about the things that interest them, all of this is it can be important for these sorts of topics. Okay. We'll do the questions at the end, so I'll just go through the slides now. I don't have very many slides, but in any case, however, in addition to what I just, in addition to the very short definition that I gave you, social-cultural ethnography usually also entails these things. And these are things, this is not something that I really read anywhere. This is after reflecting upon my own field work over the past 15 years or so, I've really thought about what makes ethnography different in my view. And of course, other people have written about a lot of these things, but this is, a lot of this is my own subjective view, and I understand that some of the speakers today, they may disagree with me, and that's fine, because ethnography is really very subjective, and it's really based on the researcher's own interpretations. So, as I said before, there's many different ways to do ethnography. So one thing that I think is important about ethnography is the fact that ethnographers tend to enter into a dialogue or a conversation with the persons they study. This makes it different than a sort of a questionnaire where there's 10 questions that the researcher must ask everybody and the persons are simply expected to answer something short. Instead, ethnographers want to pay attention to the understandings and the explanations given by the people that we're talking with. And we don't know if what our interviewees say is always true in a factual sense. We can never know that, okay? But one of the things that I think it's important to remember is even so-called lies, even when we find out from other sources that what the the people we're interviewing, when what they have said is not true, they may believe what they're saying, but we may find out that it conflicts with something else we find out about. Even in that case, their so-called lies tell us something about their experiences and culture, so that we're still finding out about attitudes and beliefs and things like this. So truth is not our objective necessarily. We want to understand how people understand the reality around them, how people understand other people, and that's always a process of negotiation. So every time you have a conversation with a friend, when you're not doing research, you are trying to figure out the world together. This is quite a symbolic anthropological point of view, but I think it's fairly well accepted by most people doing ethnography that we are negotiating with everybody around us every day about what is the reality that we see and how do we understand other people. And this is what we're doing with people that we interview as well when we have conversations with them. So together we are creating a kind of a joint reality. So it doesn't mean that it's not a question of are we getting the real facts or the real data from them. We are together creating new ways of understanding and trying, especially when the people that are involved belong to or identify with two different cultures. And that could be also mainstream culture and a subculture. It could be people coming from two different countries and so on and forth. People are social beings and we are always trying to understand others. Okay, so that's one thing I think is important, is this dialogue or conversation. Another thing is that ethnographers tend to use what I could call a fine-grained analytic method. And that just means that we are paying attention, critical attention. I mean, we're thinking critically about this. We're questioning. We're wondering all the time about these things. But we're paying attention to details. Details that we see when we're interviewing and we hear from our interviewees, details that we see around us if we're participating in their lives. And we often become something like micro-historians. We start taking an interesting detail and following it where it's going and see what is that? What is this interesting detail I see about this culture that I don't know what it means? And so we're paying attention to details, and we may come up with new interview questions. We may come up with completely new topics in that way. So we're not locked into a certain set of questions. I'll come back to that in a moment. And the other thing that I think many of us do and should continue doing is that we contextualize what we study. And that means we're putting it into different frames of reference. We're trying to understand not just one small thing, but what is the social background? What is the cultural background, the historical background, or political, or economic, or psychological of this thing that we're studying? So these are what I call kind of different levels of context that we are trying to get more background information all the time about what it is we're trying to understand. We can't understand everything. That's impossible. But the more background information we have, I think all of us have probably seen this ourselves, the more background information we have, the easier it is to explain why people do what they do and why they believe what they believe. And also then there's these micro and macro levels of causation. So a micro level of causation could be somebody's, you know, something coming from someone's own psychological background, something that is an individual motivation, although usually those are also social motivations. And macro levels could be things like government policy, what's happening on a larger global scale. And trying to fit those two together is also something that ethnographers are often trying to do. So they do need more than interviews often. They do need more background macro information about what's happening in the society that they are studying. Okay, and then another aspect that I think is really important for ethnography is that ethnographers usually refuse to take at face value prevailing public or media discourse or concepts. We understand that there's a lot of rhetoric out there, that there's a lot of concepts which are created and maintained for political purposes, so that some groups can stay in power and others maybe lose power, so that certain kinds of ideologies or grand narratives continue. And this is a postmodernist view, but I think that it's fairly well accepted by most socio and cultural ethnographers that, you know, you don't have to be a postmodernist researcher to understand that a lot of basic concepts about, let's say, for example, women in the Middle East, or other concepts, you know, that they're very powerfully loaded with ideas, you know, that we have to save these women who are wearing veils and so on and so forth, or, you know, Islam is this, or the poor in Africa are this, or something like this, and that we have to understand that those are not depictions of reality, as I've written here, but they are rhetorical representations, and actually they're products of the culture of policymakers and media themselves. So the people that are creating the media, the people that are creating policies, often these concepts that we see in the media or in policy reflect their culture, not the culture of the people we're talking about, or the culture of the people that we want to study. And this is what ethnographers can do, I think, is that ethnographers go to the actual people themselves and ask them, how do you feel about this? How do you see yourselves? How do you understand this situation? And I think that's very important, so that we can then use our empirical data to deconstruct these discourses and challenge prevailing conceptualizations. Because many of these rhetorical media and policy concepts, they limit or constrain or oversimplify the way we understand reality. And since most of us or all of us are trying to maybe help solve current social issues, then understanding reality, at least as it's seen by different groups of people, is an important goal. And finally, the last aspect I want to bring up about ethnography is what has been called an open notebook approach. And in this open notebook approach, the researcher avoids using the same fixed set of questions for every interview and remains flexible and open to asking new questions as he or she learns new things from his interviewees. So it's a process. You start out, of course, you have to begin with a set of questions, but as you notice that sometimes the interviewees consider some questions to be completely uninteresting and they want to talk about this thing over here, then often we begin to change what it is we're focusing on, because we realize that, aha, here's this completely new concept over here, or a completely new topic that I knew nothing about. I'm going to ask more about this. And so we usually, ethnographers start our open-ended interviews by giving respondents a chance to spontaneously give us new information. Yes, we have certain, maybe we start out with a set of 10 questions just to get started, but we know that eventually this is going to lead us somewhere else. And this is perfectly acceptable in ethnography. And through ethnography, I think that ethnography is one of the few methods where it's possible to do this, we can find out things that we had no idea existed before. So this is different, for example, in sociology or other social sciences, where sociologists often have to use surveys because they want a different type of data, which is also very important, but they have to have a sense of what they're studying before they make their surveys and distribute them. But ethnographers have, in a sense, the freedom to go and discover new things. So it's not absolutely necessary to know what you're going to study. It can be very, it can make a lot of people nervous, or, you know, feel a bit unsure that, a lot of people want to know, if you're going, for example, to another country to study something, you want to know exactly what you're going to study. But ethnographers, unfortunately, they have to be, or fortunately or unfortunately, must be quite flexible, must be quite ready to realize that they don't know what they're going to discover when they get to the field, and to keep a very open mind, and to be ready to respond very quickly to changing circumstances. Okay. So that was what I wanted to say about ethnography, and I'll take questions, but I wanted to talk briefly about ethics. So we've heard a lot about ethics, and we're going to hear a lot more in the humanities and social sciences. This is becoming much more of an issue which is being brought up at every level of our research. And I can give you a comparative example. When I was a PhD student in the early 1990s, it was still possible, and I heard that some researchers did this, it was still possible to hide a tape recorder in your pocket, go to another country, and secretly record people's voices, and they had no idea that they were actually being recorded. And that, fortunately, has all changed now. So that's not possible to do anymore. It's completely unethical to record people's voices and when they have no idea that they're being recorded. But things have changed very quickly just in the time that I've been a researcher. And they will continue to change. So what the first thing I want to urge you is make sure that you're keeping up with the latest discussions about ethics in your field. That's very important. It's going to be very important for getting funding, getting money for your research. Okay, now there are two main branches of practical ethical considerations for researchers. And the first, there should be one and two. For some reason, there's one and one here. The first is being fair and honest to the scientific community. So that means being fair and honest to other researchers. So that means no plagiarism, not borrowing ideas from other people's texts without giving them credit, reporting your data honestly. So, what you have interviewed and what you have recorded that people have said, that you don't embellish that or change it. Sometimes there is it's very tempting to do so, especially if you're not getting the information you want, or if there's some kind of really conflicting answers or something. But being as fair and honest as possible in reporting your data, when you write up your data in your dissertation, for example, or in articles, that's important. Respecting intellectual property rights, so things like photographs, illustrations, and other property, intellectual property that belongs to someone else, including texts, that we need to get the permission of those people who actually have the intellectual property rights. And storing your data so that it can be checked and used by future researchers. This is usually after you yourself have used it, after you have written your dissertation and you're not actively using your data. Nowadays, the idea is that we should not destroy data, especially when it's been paid for by other outside funding organizations, by foundations or by the university. So the idea is that we're going to try to store it in some digital archive somewhere and put metadata tags, which is just basically the information so that the keywords and the descriptions, so that other researchers can someday find it, and when they're searching, that they come up and they find your data. And to put it in a format that 30 years from now, somebody can still use it. It's not some obsolete, strange format that there's no way they can access it. So we have to think about those things, and those will increasingly be things that you're going to have to spell out when you're asking for funding, that you're going to have to write it down in your funding application, because increasingly foundations and university want to know what is your data management plan. Okay, and then the second part about ethics, the one that I'm going to focus on now, is protecting and being honest to the people we study. So that's very important, and sometimes it's very difficult, especially if we go into areas where there's war or there's conflict or things like this, then it's not always clear how we can protect ourselves as researchers, but also how we can protect the people that we are interviewing. Okay, so here's just a list of ethical issues in ethnographic research. I'm sure that there are more than this. These are the ones that came to my mind because these are the ones that I've had to write down when I'm applying for funding. So I'm sure there are many more which will be brought up today by other lecturers. So the first is this full disclosure about who the researcher is. And I bring this up because this is one of the issues which is brought up in one of the articles which you can choose for your homework. So there's four possible articles for the homework, for the coursework, and one of them is about a woman carrying out, an Indian woman who's carrying out research, participant observation in Mumbai. And she says very clearly in her article that she doesn't tell the people she's studying who she really is. And she understands that this is an ethical problem, but there's real clear reasons why she had to hide her identity. And this is really an ethical difficulty. So if this intrigues you, then you can read that article. It's in English. So, but generally, or I would say, you know, always is the goal, that we should tell the researcher, tell the people we're studying who we are, where we come from. We represent this university, we come from this country, etc. Now, that's not always easy because, for example, the people that I interviewed in Tanzania, they came from a slum. Most of them did not have very much or no education. And when I tried to explain to them what a university was, they had no idea what I was talking about. The only white people they had seen in that area were from NGOs, were people from development organizations coming to give them money. So after five years when I was visiting and revisiting them, they still thought I was from an NGO. That was what made sense to them. And I understand that. So sometimes the full disclosure can be a bit difficult because we're coming, there's two people from two different, very different worlds, and trying to make each other understandable to the other can be challenging. The second is full disclosure about the purpose of the research and what the information will be used for. And this is very important. Very often it's done in a written form so that you give your interviewees a piece of paper where it says very clearly in black and white what the research is for, what the information that they give, what it will be used for. But again, in my case in Tanzania, this was also very difficult. I couldn't give them something in a written form because many of them didn't read. Some of them read, could read in Swahili, for example. But it makes these things much more challenging. But that's the goal, is to give full disclosure. Okay? Then there's informed consent, and that means that we get the permission of the people we interview. And informed means that they really know what's going on. They really understand what you're going to be doing with this research. Therefore, since they are fully informed, they can now give their consent or give their permission. Okay, and again, if in my case that was a bit challenging, but I just kept saying it over and over and hoping that, you know, that eventually some people, of course, understood me, and others maybe less so in Tanzania. But of course, if I'd been talking to educated or middle class people in Tanzania, this would have been no problem. But I was talking to the very poorest of the poor, which was I was focusing on poverty. So also, it's important to make clear to the people we're interviewing that they can withdraw at any time. That just because they've given permission to be interviewed doesn't mean that, you know, they're stuck there. They're now imprisoned by the interview. But if they start to feel uncomfortable, if they don't have time, they can leave. They can leave the research situation. So we need to make that clear to the people we are interviewing or studying. And anonymity, which is really, really important. I'm a professor of ethnology, and we've had a few cases where the people being interviewed want their real names to appear in the study. This has happened both in Finland, with people who were proud of what they were doing, and I had this same thing happen in Tanzania, where the people said, "You're taking our information, but you're not using our names. Isn't that like stealing?" And I said, "Yes, I understand. But the problem is that everything we write nowadays has the very high possibility of ending up on the internet. And once it's on the internet, it's not, you can't remove it fully. How do we know what this information will be used for 20 years from now, 50 years from now? We cannot always know for what political purposes that information could be taken and used, and even if it doesn't affect the people we're interviewing right now, it might affect their families." And so this is one reason that at least in ethnology we have made a very, very clear, we've explained to the people who want their names to be mentioned, saying, "Sorry, but ethically we are bound to change your name." And this is for everyone's protection. So that if they, you know, and maybe if somebody, if our interviewees really want to come out in their own name, maybe we can try to enable them to make their own blogs or to get their own information out there in their name. But it's not going to be through us. And this is a difficulty. And it's the other question, of course, is that many times we think we've made the people we study anonymous. We've changed their names. But if it's a small community, it may still be possible to easily identify them if we don't change the name of the place. Or if we're talking about their occupation, they're the only tailor in this small village, for example, then everyone can easily see who they are. Or if it's a small area where for example, there was actually a case in Kenya where there was a community, a Muslim community, where a researcher went to interview women. And then she wrote afterwards quite critically about Muslim women's experiences. And she said that she had made these women anonymous. But later, people from that community said that they all knew who those women were who had been interviewed because they'd seen the women be interviewed with this white person. So it's we have to be very careful. And it's just nowadays what I've done is I've changed the names of the place and the people. And I can say, because it's a large enough area, and now that the names of the places are changed, I just gave them fake names. So now I can say more data about the people, the age, their occupation, and so forth, because, for example, it's in Dar es Salaam, but there's like 5 million people living in Dar es Salaam. So each researcher has to think very carefully about these questions. And then data management I've already mentioned, so how to store our data so that others can find and use it. The idea nowadays from the people who are funding our research, the foundations, the university, the idea is when they pay for us to go out and collect or produce the data, they want to make sure that that data that they've paid for is available to researchers in, for example, in Finnish society at a future date to use so that it's not destroyed or it doesn't just end up in the closet of or the hard drive of the individual researcher and can never be used again by anyone else. So that's where we're, at least at the moment, that's the trend that we're going towards. Okay, the other thing we need to think about when we're interviewing people, in my view, is possible trauma and stress. There's a number of areas of life that people may feel uncomfortable about talking about, and this can be very much dependent on culture. So in some cultures, it can be sexual matters. In some cultures, it can be drinking alcohol, which I found in Finland, where I was a bit surprised when I first came to Finland 25 years ago, that talking about alcohol use was something that was kind of embarrassing for Finns, whereas I came from the United States, and drinking alcohol was not a big deal there. But talking about sexual matters was a big deal in the United States. So things can be different according to culture. And of course, talking about experiences in war, talking about if someone's had experiences of being a victim of violence or even a perpetrator of violence. Okay, so not everyone that we interview is victims, especially in times of conflict. People can be both victims and the ones who did the violence. So we need to be careful. There's lots and lots of very difficult areas that we don't want to cause more trauma and stress to our interviewees. So we need to be very careful in that way. And then I think a very important question that has been, at least in the circles of anthropology and ethnology, which I represent, has been this long discussion for the last 30 years at least, or 30 or 40 years, of how should we represent those we study. In the 1940s and 50s and even 60s, the idea was that a well-educated, usually white male anthropologist could go to another country and he would stay there for 2 or 3 years and he would write everything, supposedly, about this culture, and he would come back and he would write a book, and this would be the authoritative description of that culture. And end of story. You know, he was the authority on it, and he had now described everything that was important. And fortunately, now we have many other voices that have come and said, no, wait a second, you know, what about the people themselves who live in that culture. How do they see it? How would a woman have seen it? How would a woman from that culture have seen it? So how would a minority group in that culture, wouldn't they have seen it differently? We understand that now there are so many more voices. In addition to which, there's many other questions about representing those we study. If we are interviewing people who have less education than us, are we supposed to write the way that they talk, which may stigmatize them, which clearly show that they have less education? Or should we clean it up? You know, as others, all of these, there's many, many, many issues about representing. Every choice we make as a researcher, when we make the interviews, we are already leaning toward a particular kind of representation. And then especially when we are writing up, deciding what to write on the basis of our interviews and deciding how to write about it, it's always a question of our choices of how to represent those people. So there is, in a sense, no right or wrong answer to this. It's always going to be subjective. The important thing nowadays is to be honest, to say when we write the article or the dissertation, to try to think as much as possible. Yes, for example, myself, I say, I'm a white educated woman who went to these slums in Tanzania. I saw only probably certain things. There were many things I missed. I didn't speak Swahili fluently. I was focusing on these issues. People surely told me certain things that they wanted me to hear, and I need to reflect on how I'm now representing them and to really think about that and to understand that there's many other possibilities for how those people could have been represented, so that mine is not the only and final answer or a final description of this. So I think these are the ethical issues, and there are surely more, but these are some of the ones that I've grappled with. And okay, this is just so you can see a quick. I'm going to be quiet for a minute and let you read this. This is just so that you can see how I have written about ethics when I'm applying for funding to do research. And this is. I'm not saying this is the only right way to write about it or this is the best way, but this is just to give you some ideas of how, you know, when you have a research plan and they say, write about ethics, or they may not even ask you to write about ethics, but you should anyway, especially nowadays. And just to give you a sense of what somebody else has written, so I'll be quiet for a minute if you want to, if you can hopefully see the font. So in any case, you can see that it's a bit complex, and at least you've got the video seems to have turned itself off. Yeah, here. Did I walk too far away?
It's still on.
Okay,
just
got it. Okay. So in any case, you can see that quite a bit needs to be said, especially if you're interviewing. Your ethics section should be at least this long. Many people feel that, I don't really know what to say in the ethics section, but there's a lot of things that need to be covered. And the people who are evaluating your funding applications, they will be looking very closely to make sure that you have covered everything, that you recognize what you need to think about and what you need to plan for. Okay. And this is my second to last slide. So, will researchers in the humanities and social sciences soon need ethical permits to do research? And I'm beginning to think yes. If you are studying any of the following topics, so if you are studying children, that is, according to international law, anyone under the age of 18, for example, a popular topic this year and last year has been asylum seekers. I've applied for money myself to study the migrants and asylum seekers who are coming to Finland, and it's very possible to study them in other places as well. Migration is a very what would I say, important and very much studied topic now in Europe. But in any case, these are people who, especially with the current asylum seekers coming to Finland from Iraq, Somalia, Afghanistan, and Syria, they have, many of them, or most of them, have been through very traumatic experiences, either in their home countries or coming here. So there needs to be a lot of ethical thinking about interviewing them, and you will probably need a permit. Persons with disabilities and or special needs, a broad category, so that anyone that you feel needs special protection or needs to be needs to be approached with a little bit more thought than you would just talk to someone on the street, perhaps, needs then an ethical permit probably. And there's other people who obviously need special protection. These are people who are big victims of violence, abuse. Anytime you want to talk about sexuality or racism, crime, or if you're talking to people from closed religious or closed political groups, relatively closed. So the point is that, and any topics that could cause traumatic memories or distress. So my advice to you is that if you are intending to study any of these things, you probably should start thinking about applying for a research permit from the University of Jyväskylä Ethical Committee. And the reason I say this is because this very well could give you an advantage, especially when applying for funding. You know, if you have that permit and somebody else doesn't, who's studying a similar topic, well, you can imagine that the evaluators are going to really appreciate the fact that you've gone to the extra trouble. So how do you do this? In a moment, I will show you. Well, here's the name. If you Google, if you go to the university website and you just put in this Eetinen toimikunta into the search function, you will get their website. And it's basically it's a board of people who are coming from all the different faculties of the university. And you have to. There's a lot of paperwork involved. I've done it. Some of the other people sitting here who are lecturers have done it. So basically, there's a lot of paperwork you have to do, but there's people who can help. You can come and ask me for help. And then submit your first application to the ethical committee well in advance. So they want the application before their meeting deadline, but make sure that you submit maybe several meetings before you need the permit, because what they might do is say, well, we have some questions about your paperwork. Could you kind of clarify this and maybe add something to this? And then you have to turn it in again. So that'll give you time. But in the end, when we applied for it this year, me and my research team, we got the ethical permit. So and then we could include it with our application for funding. So even though we are in the humanities and social sciences and maybe we're not used to doing this, I really think that it's coming. It's a coming expectation and will give us more an advantage over when we're... It's always a competition when we're applying for funding. So basically, then important ethical bodies is this University of Jyväskylä Ethical Committee, and then also the National Advisory Board on Research Ethics in Finland, this TENK. If you Google this, you will find it, and they have advice. They have different ethical considerations. Many of them, of course, are for the natural sciences or the hard sciences, but there can be very useful ideas. So there's different sources, and actually each discipline probably has their own code of ethics. I know that the American Anthropological Association had a code of ethics. Now I tried to find it on their website, and I couldn't find it anymore. I know that the sociologists have their own code of ethics, and so on and so forth. So try to find out what is the code of ethics for your own discipline, and you can refer to that. And that helps give you ideas also about how to write these ethics for example, for your funding plan. Okay, now there's just a little bit of time, so I'll be happy to take questions. And I'll, maybe if I give Jukka the microphone, I'll use this one, yeah.
Any questions? Comments? Be brave.
Okay. Oh, yes, over here. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Yes, I was thinking about when you said about the ethical permission, and I myself tested it on deaf asylum seeker, tried to apply for the ethical permission, and I was thinking how I could ask the asylum seekers, not the ethical board, but the asylum seekers, and, you know, is it okay for me to interview them, and how would they understand the University of Jyväskylä? I tried showing them a picture, and I videotaped this. And then later on, and I showed them a picture of myself typing on a computer and using a picture of them, and I sort of, through videos and pictures, tried to explain to them what I would do with the information, and I felt that they understood what I was trying to explain.
Great. Yeah, that's. I think visual approaches are very, very useful, and especially for people who maybe have had less education. Education makes us very text oriented. So for those, even those people who have not had that kind of formal text oriented education have still seen lots of pictures. They've maybe, you know, depending on where they're coming from, they've taken pictures with, you know, small cameras and things. So that's a great approach. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the beginning. Did you have a question as well, or was it just you were just commenting on your own experience?
No, this was only my only comment and sort of a hint for others.
Yeah.
How to get the permit for interviewing consent.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Very good.
You didn't talk about issues of reciprocity or gifts given when you go to countries like the third world countries. What do you do on this ethical dilemma?
Thank you. That's a very good question. A very important ethical question. I will tell you that when I interviewed people in Tanzania, I gave them 2 kilos of sugar to each interviewee. And why was that? Because I felt that when these people didn't even have their basic needs met, they didn't have enough food, they didn't necessarily have enough water, they certainly didn't have enough money, I felt that because I was taking away from their time that they might be running small businesses or something, that I needed to give something back. I had Finnish colleagues who were also working in the same city in Dar es Salaam, and they said that in their discipline, it was very unethical to give anything. Very unethical to give anything in return. However, they were interviewing educated middle-class people. And so I felt that there was a difference in this, and some people have asked me, well, if you're giving them sugar, don't you think that they are telling you what you want to hear? And I said, he would like the microphone. And I'll just say quickly that that's a concern, but the question is, how do they know what I want to hear? You know, and they, in fact, there were many times when I would say, "Is it so?" And they said, no, I disagree. It's like this." Or they would many times contradict me, which was very good, and disagree with me. So I felt that the gift giving was not prohibiting most of them from telling me what they thought. But also I think that, of course, they were telling me how poor they were and that they needed help. This was what they were used to telling people from NGOs. But for other things, when we were just talking about cultural attitudes, I think that they couldn't know, you know, what I wanted to hear, because I tried to be very open-ended. But I felt it was only fair to give this to them. So please, your comment.
Look, I have the issue of gaining accessibility, for instance, to policymakers, and they demand some kind of, I don't want to call it bribe, but hand washing something. That's, they have a term for it. And what do you do in this case? Do you have to state it? Is it ethical to give so the doors could be open for you? You have secretaries who are gatekeepers, and before they allow you to see the boss, you have to lubricate the gate. What do you do about this?
Yep. I was very lucky in the sense that I never needed to give any of this little, in Swahili, kitu kidogo. I didn't have to give any of that to anyone. And the reason was is that I made a contact with a Tanzanian NGO quite early, and they introduced me to this neighborhood and said, she's with us. So after that, they just accepted me. I brought a little gift, like a little package of coffee for the chairman or the secretary, just to show my respect. But they never expected it. They never asked for money. So we had a really good relationship. And that was because I first made contact with this NGO who understood what I was trying to do and was run by a Tanzanian man. So that worked. Of course, one of the things that happened is that as I got to know the people living there, they began to ask for money. Please help me with this and this and this. And I said, I told them, I very much sympathize with your situation, but I told them that I'm not allowed ethically to take to give money. I'll give you, you know, here's the sugar, which I'm giving to each interviewee, the same amount. But I'm not allowed to give you money. And they accepted that. And so that was okay. So I was lucky in that way. I didn't run into that. But I had a friend who was from Malawi, a professor, Malawian professor. And he said, you shouldn't be giving the sugar to those people, because then when we, who are the African researchers, when we come, then we don't have the money to give them the sugar. And then they expect from us. So I told him, I said, I understand. I understand very well your situation. And I am sorry. And it's very difficult ethical challenges, which I think are good to discuss with everyone. Yeah. Okay. Oh, Shimi.
I have the same similar question, but what if it was the other way around? What if the informants were giving the gifts to the researcher? Because I'm usually put in a situation where they think I'm going to help them in some way, or I might bring them benefits or that way, and they keep giving me gifts, and it puts me in a situation where I have to think, is it okay to be critical of them after I receive the gifts, or if I write it the way I see it, and if it does not benefit them, how will this affect the relationship between me and the informant?
That's a very difficult question, especially in cultures where it would be offensive to refuse the gift. So in that case, luckily the Tanzanians didn't have that tradition of giving me. What happened was is when I became very good friends with somebody there, then there was gift, but there was, in a way, gift giving on both sides, so then it was okay when I became their friend. But in that case, I think that for you, because you're coming from a similar cultural background or somehow, I think the best way is just to use your instincts and to kind of try to wiggle out of it as best you can. I think that's what everyone ends up doing. But if someone was coming, for example, from Europe to India, it would be wisest for them to ask the people around them, what should I do? What should I do to least offend these people, but also not to get myself in this situation of obligation? But that's a very good point, that these kinds of things are very difficult, because then we're not talking about, you know, rules and regulations anymore. We're talking about people and their feelings. So it becomes very messy. Yeah.
Okay, thank you for this lecture. I would like to comment on this issue about paying the informants. I have this experience from Finland. I tried to find teachers to answer my survey questionnaires, and it was very difficult to get any answers, and they were so busy and everything. And I was told that if I had offered something like tickets for movies or something, they would have been motivated to answer. And then I was also told, because I said that, I'm sorry, I don't have budget for that. I didn't realize that I have to give something back for them. They said that it's normal nowadays that for many disciplines, it's always like if you answer this, you get something back. So I think this is something that we also here in Finland, we have to start to figure what are we going to do and how expensive gifts we give them just to give us some answer.
Yes, this is so interesting, and this is one reason why it's important that we continually have a dialogue. This situation is changing all the time, that we make sure that we continue to discuss, because the only way that we probably will ever arrive at some kind of consensus on what we should do is just by discussing it together. There is no sort of rules above us, you know, that telling us exactly what we should do in each case. So it's going to be the discussion amongst the researchers.
Any other questions? Yeah,
I just would like to add that at the music department, it is very, very common to give movie tickets to participants of music listening experiments. I beg your pardon? Yeah, no, it's but that, you know, we don't call them informants, we call them, you know, participants, or they just come to do some experiments with us, and it's common practice. I mean, when the person has a budget to give Finkin or movie tickets to each of them, it's... And of course, and I've noticed when this research that we do here is published afterwards in the article, it's very common to mention what was given to each participant. Okay. So okay. It says each participant was rewarded with whatever, you know, so it is okay. Transparent.
I think this is very interesting how these practices change at different paces in different disciplines. In ethnology, this is still new for us, but clearly in music studies, it's already a common practice. So this is very interesting, and we need to keep this dialogue open so that we know what we're doing, and as was said, maybe make in our budget some money for these movie tickets for the people that we interview and participants.
Any other questions or comments?
Oh, I think PLV had. Oh no. Okay.
Because I think we should have a line between this facilitation and then calling facilitation. Mm. If I have a focus group, I can give lunch or some snacks. Mm. These are okay, but they divide it for, but for outright purchase of information or primary. Mm.
Yes. Right, right. So in a way, you're making a distinction between the people who are, in the focus groups, the people who are giving us their time, their information, and that's been agreed upon, versus that perhaps we have to make a line between that and having to pay basically bribes to people that are maybe gatekeepers that are allowing us access or allowing, so that's a different question. And I agree. It's of course, in many countries, it's very difficult. I mean, the access is only given with this little bit of money that you give them. And I would say also that in, for example, in African countries, there's been a lot of talk about how bribes are, you know, they're so bad and they're illegal. And yet it's a different logic, I find. I don't want to go and judge and say that that's bad, because there's a logic behind that. The people that are in particular positions, I'm just thinking doctors, teachers, etc., they also have, like, you know, 20 or 50 relatives who are depending on the money that they get, and that they are expected to get these bribes so that they can distribute it to these larger kinship networks. They're not just necessarily putting it in some kind of Swiss bank account or something, you know. So it's a different kind of trickle-down logic, where it's easy for us to say here in Finland that they shouldn't be doing that because we have a government which is subsidizing the medical and educational systems. So I think that these are very difficult ethical questions, yes.
Anyone else? Any comments or questions?
Oh, Miriam, did you? No, it was. Oh, no, okay. Okay. So I think we're ready for the next speaker then, and welcome Pilvi Hamin Oho.
Hello everybody. Yes. Okay. So I'm Pilvi Hämeenaho. I am a postdoctoral researcher at the Department of History and Ethnology. I am an ethnologist, just as Laura. And I am currently working in my own project. I will tell you briefly about it later. But today I will speak about what is lay expertise, and especially in questions related to social services and healthcare, which I study. And I will address these topics of collecting qualitative data, how to analyze it, and what kind of ethical questions there are when we are dealing with these questions. This is mainly about knowledge and how can we define what kind of knowledge we have and how to use it. So what is lay expertise? As this is my key word today, I give you brief description. I understand lay knowledge as something that people derive from the social contexts of their everyday lives. So this is something which Laura was talking about, that it's not just what they say, but the whole world or life experience that people have and in which they create meanings and understand things in their lives. And what can we learn from lay experts? So laymen with their lay knowledge, but they have expertise on something, and especially lay experts in this social and healthcare services, as I said. So how to use and analyze data which represents different knowledge systems? And now I refer to things that, for example, in healthcare, there is professional knowledge, for example, which doctors have. And then we have this lay knowledge, which can be about the same issue, for example, about some disease. But it's lay knowledge, and it's very different kind of knowledge, and actually this can be understood representing the whole knowledge systems. I have collected mainly qualitative data, and I use ethnographic approach, especially when I'm trying to analyze my different kind of data sets I have been collecting. And one thing which is like daily practice to me is to think about this. When I have knowledge it comes from different knowledge systems, there are all kind of differences and also misinterpretations between them. I can make those, or people in those service systems, when they meet, they do not understand each other. There may be also false truths or false knowledge. And when I try to figure out something about what's going on with these people in these negotiations with professional and laymen, what's going on, who knows and what, sometimes I feel like that I'm just lost there between all these different knowledges and ways of understanding things. Here is also the mention of discussing in small groups. I was thinking about that, but let's see if we have any time. I can give you a few questions that you can also ponder afterwards if we don't have time for these group discussions. My project is called Bridging the Cultural Gaps in Service Chains. And it's a 3-year project which is funded by Academy of Finland from the field of ethnology. And in this project, I focus in collaboration. I have these groups, different groups. I have interviewed and collected surveys from them, and I'm now pretty much in the middle of my project. I am trying to now create a map where these different groups with their different kind of knowledges meet. And I would say something about the collaboration, how it works, how we could advance some, because there are some challenges which I think that we should find solutions. So this collaboration would be more fluid. These groups are parents of special needs children, so I do not study the children. I haven't interviewed children, but their parents. Then teachers, especially the special education teachers, and professionals from social and healthcare. So these groups are gathered around children with special needs and collaboration
they collaborate in order to make the child's life easier and better, especially in school. And I have collected interviews, questionnaires, and surveys, and I also read a lot of official documents about disabled, rights of the disabled, rights of children, and also what kind of documents we have which lead our thinking, what's supposed to be done in school, how social and healthcare works, all kind of official ways of describing these issues. For example, I am now studying or trying to figure out how child, as simply as it sounds, how it is defined in different kind of documents and discourses. This is what Laura talked about, that there are so many discourses around us, and we have to understand that they are not facts, or they do not represent the only possible reality. When you start to read documents from education, field of education, or from healthcare, you just find different kind of childs everywhere. So this kind of analyzing what kind of child, who is the child we are studying, or who is this child in the middle of this collaborating network which I'm studying. And so there is all kind of, or different kind of knowledge and ways of understanding. And this, what I said earlier, these different knowledge systems, I refer to what Ingeri Koskinen has written about. I have these references in the end of my presentation. So she has thought a lot about how could we address these questions, also from the ethical point of view, whose knowledge we should rely on and when, and what are the limits of ethnographer to make those decisions, that who should we listen and when. So my project aims to address these challenges in this collaboration. Also, I would love to find good practices and spread them. And by this analysis of these different knowledge bases, I would like to understand the reasons behind these challenges, why they are there. Mostly they are, what I've been studying, they are cultural differences between these different groups. It's like a cultural system which has its own knowledge systems. So that's what I am trying to figure out and explain in order to get better collaboration and better services for special needs children. So if I study services, social and healthcare services, who should I ask to know if they are good, if they are doing what they are supposed to do, or if they are not good? And of course, it's a question of what do I want to know? If I want to see how customers experience the services, in my study, these customers are parents of the real customers, which are the children. I should ask and find out their experiences and understand why they feel about the services as they do. Then if I want to understand how some service pathways go, for example, the child goes to some, there are some examinations done, they try to understand what is there, what kind of support that child needs, and then therapies begin, there is some special support in school, it's like a service pathway. What happens there? Why things are done, then I have to ask those professionals who are involved in this service procedures or processes. But if I, as I'm a very idealistic researcher, maybe even sometimes too much, I would love to know what's best for a child and how to create the system so it would be like that, then I would need all the knowledge there is. That's how I think, but during my project I have learned that there are many, many opinions which are not like this. I have been told that by a member of certain group, that don't ask them, they don't understand. They only see their viewpoint. And I have been told that that's false knowledge, don't listen to them. We know what's best for a child. And this is quite interesting, as I have asked all people to join my research. I have then told them that this is about the collaboration. I would like to learn about the collaboration and all kind of these walls and some sort of... it doesn't sound too collaborative when I'm told that you shouldn't rely on those people's knowledge or something. But that's the goal, best for a child. So who knows? I refer to Collins and Evans here. They have been writing about expertise. And they say that we should prefer the judgments of those who know what they are talking about. And they have made this distinction between expertise as a status. For example, when I have finished my dissertation, I say that, okay, minor expert, but now I have expertise on this thing and I have my doctoral degree and it proves something. It's a status, or you are a professor or of something. Then you have the status and you, people see you as an expert. Most likely you are, if you are a professor. But then there is another kind of expertise which is acquired through socialization into the practices of an expert group. And this is not a question about status, but knowing what those people know who experience something in their own life. So that's like based on experience and also so not just your personal private experience, but as a member of a group. So who knows and what knows? Healthcare professionals, which I now use as an example about the professional expertise, they have professional knowledge. In healthcare, there are various fields of science. Even professionals are quite strictly, most often they are committed to one field of knowledge. The healthcare professionals as a group, they cover a huge amount of scientific knowledge. And they are trained and skilled experts. And of course in their work they follow professional ethics. And there are official guidelines which they have to follow and which most likely when they follow them end up with the best possible solution and best practices. But we also have lay experts in healthcare. Nowadays in Finland actually this is quite common to bring lay experts into negotiations and into training of professionals also. But they are experts by having experience. And they may have very comprehensive view, for example, on some certain health problem and medication. They live with certain illness, they live with the medication, and they also meet with the professionals. So they see what professionals see about the disease, but also it's there with them in their daily life contexts all the time. But then, of course, there is this critique that this is limited, this lay expert's knowledge, because it's limited to one's own or peers' experiences. And it's possible that there is no any kind of education or training related to that health problem, but only the experience. During my research, I have met many people who actually have more multifaceted knowledge base than just what I said about lay expertise being just there by having this experience. I have interviewed parents about their children's life and all these disabilities they have and what kind of service pathways they have been going on. And of course they learn a lot during that process, when they are the ones who take care of all things when the children are small and unable to act themselves. So they have, of course, acquired this expertise through being member of this group of special needs children's parents. But they also may have professional knowledge on issues. I have interviewed, for example, a parent who was also a nurse, a parent who was also a special education teacher. There were also one parent who was a patient organization activist, and he had met so many people, and he had been there, for example, writing reports and collecting data that could be given to policymakers, for example. So it's just not your own experience. It's not just lay knowledge. So when I interviewed them, I had to be aware that even they have came to me as a parent, and they talked as a parent. Sometimes there was this intertwining of this knowledge system. Sometimes they said something which was very professional, and it was actually based on their professional knowledge, which is trained. They had got training for. But sometimes, even it sounded very professional and very, very, very real, and it seemed like they have so many facts in their hands. Sometimes it turned out that it wasn't the case. What Laura said about these lies, which people may not say as a lie, but they just have misunderstood things. It's very difficult to know when you are interviewing someone. What does that person really know? What is he or she saying? Where to draw the line? So I have relied on the idea that they are parents who just may have all kind of knowledge, but I cannot give face value to their professional ideas, even if they have some medical education, because when there are questions, for example, related to psychiatry, it's a very, very special field of science and knowledge, what you should know. So this question that when these parents go to these negotiations and collaboration with professionals, what's their role there and how their knowledge is understood there? Of course, we know that lay knowledge has a huge significance. It may have, if we want to listen or understand its value. For example, in the field of epidemiology, where this field of research focuses on health problems, illnesses, unhealthy behavior, health inequalities. These kind of issues should be understood if you want to understand the basis or basics of those health problems. You have to, in order to understand this, you have to understand the social context, individual capabilities, and everyday life practices and motivations. Why people do not behave good, even if they know that something bad for their health. They still do otherwise. We need to understand their life much more from the wider perspective than just saying that they are doing wrong or right. It's written by Williams and Elliot that if the underlying purpose of epidemiology is indeed one of understanding causal relationships. Okay, sorry, there are mistakes. Relationships and testing theories, then it cannot do without the insights qualitative thinking provides. So we need qualitative data collection, and especially here they write about, this is a good article, about ethnographic research which has been taken among those who behave wrongly, so to say. So this is the point where ethnographic research comes to explain and help this lay knowledge to come collected and used in order to understand questions of medical sciences also.
So this is just an idea map about this collaboration, where now I do not have my focus groups, which I study, but I have put a researcher there. So professionals have their own expertise. Parents I've interviewed have their own knowledge system, multifaceted, as I said. And then researcher collects this data and analyzes that. And what for? I sort of try to put together these different knowledges, and what do I want to do with that? So what are my goals? What kind of impact I am looking for? So this case about special needs children and this collaboration and negotiations related to their treatment and rehabilitation, which is my now on my focus among my wider project. And of course, disabilities, occasion, health and social care service complexities. And also special needs are seldom stable. These children's needs vary, and further examinations and new means of treatment and rehabilitation emerge all the time. So it's the life is all the time, it can be in change, constant change, and you need to react and find new solutions. That's why these families with special needs children, the need to collaborate with specialists is a permanent part of their life. There is also a permanent need for collaboration and understanding common goals, which means that they, these different members of that network collaborating around that child, they need to understand each other. And here I think that the only way to bring these sometimes very, very remote ways of understanding or ways of seeing things, I think ethnographic approach gives really good tools for this. Not just the ways how we collect data, but also as an analytical approach. What Laura talked about, it's here in brief, that all voices, we want to hear them, we want to understand them from the speaker's perspective, how people who give us information, how they, what is the social context where that knowledge, where it wells, or how it is constructed. And then to bring these together to see the gaps and the similarities, it could provide such understanding that could be understandable for both sides or all sides. The problem in these negotiations lies in very different power relations between these agents, because we have patients or clients, and then we have doctors, these professionals, and these categories, they can be categorized very strongly. We have clear ideas about their roles. And it's not, most likely, it's not things that it's, or most often, it's not about collaboration, but they are in different level in this, like a power system. These healer-patient categories, can be defined like there is the one who helps and the one who needs help and the one who knows and the one who needs help and advice, so to say, who doesn't know and comes to ask for help. And these kind of ideas about these agents' roles, they are very strong, and they lead to the point where it's possible that a client, in this case a parent, is not heard. He is not given equal position in the negotiations because he doesn't possess the professional knowledge or status. And it's very clear when you do any study among parents with special needs children, they have a very strong feeling that they are not always heard, or their knowledge is not, and understanding is not respected, even they are talking about their own child. So this is one key point where I have started my research, that this is not good, that they have important knowledge which is not heard due to these categorizations. So this is from one interview, just a little explanation what it means that you're not heard. One mother told me that every time with a new social worker, we had to start from the beginning, go through all the child's diagnosis and rehabilitation practices. And every time, after we had gone through it, they said that they did not understand. They needed to arrange a multi-professional meeting and have a doctor's opinion. It was made very clear that all the information should come from the doctors, and that parents just do not understand. She was very frustrated. This is translation. The Finnish extract was quite powerful in the words she used, but I just have to translate it like this. She was so frustrated. She said that it's amazing how we are not given any role in these negotiations. It's amazing why they don't understand that we live with the child every day and we are the ones who actually take care of medication, rehabilitation. They tell us that we don't know. Yes. So, I have to be open about my research. It's ethical, but also because the whole research questions are based on certain goals. And I also have quite clear ideas what kind of impact I would have. So this is emancipatory research, what I'm doing. My goal is to advance understanding about different knowledge systems within these contexts of special needs children, families, school, and social and healthcare, and emphasize the significance of lay knowledge, which is now it's in the lowest level of this power steps, who is the one who's heard. So I would like to advance parents' status, or at least a position as lay experts in these negotiations with professionals. And I have been thinking myself many times, how scientific is this? Can I be this open about that I think there is this, things are wrong, and I would like to change this? Because, of course, here is the trap of becoming an advocate for some group, that I just forget that I was supposed to be a researcher, and I just start to go and tell their viewpoints and go all political about it. I'm not going to do that. But I am. I think that what Williams and Elliot say, it's enough scientific for me that I can rely on this, that qualitative thinking and evidence collected with sympathetic personal observation and or reading is the tool how we can understand the social contexts. And they also write about the need for being sensitive to margins, marginal groups, sub- and countercultures. Because otherwise we fall into that trap that we just take as a fact all these categories and labels and discourses which are there representing the, so to say, current system. We have to see further, and we have to look behind it and see what's going on here. But of course, this is still a big issue, how to avoid becoming an advocate instead of researcher. Whose viewpoints should I take into account in my analysis about this collaboration and negotiations? And several times I have already been with this question that I have to admit that my informants are wrong, but What do I mean by that? How to deal with the false knowledge and such mistakes and misunderstandings, which are very fatal in these negotiations. They are such mistakes or misunderstandings that underline that fact that lay knowledge is not in any way possible to see equal with professional knowledge. I have to admit that, and I have to deal with the problem that sometimes when I try to pull these knowledge, different kind of knowledges together, there is actually a point where you can say that this is wrong and this is right. So what about this false knowledge? Of course, this is also about how the research questions are posed and being open about my intentions. And then in analysis, very, very important thing is to only answer the questions one is able to with the data one has. I cannot start writing because I just happen to know. I have to stick with my data. And of course, I also have to remember what Collins and Evans say, that to know what you are talking about does not mean you are right. For example, experts with the status of experts, they disagree all the time. Think about the leading researchers and scientists who have the status of expert. They compete, they disagree all the time. So there is no just one single truth. So what about this knowledge about those we are not, who are not taken seriously because their knowledge is no good, even if those with that status of expert cannot find agreement in certain issues. So, of course, informants, viewpoints, what they say, how they tell me things, they are the truth. This is what Laura talked about. It's their truth in their life context, in that social context where they live. So what they say, they illuminate their real thinking, which in these cases, for example, how were the services, what has happened, tell me what kind of experiences you've had. They are real experiences and memories they talk about. They are not to be considered equal with professionals' understanding, for example, whether the service was good, if there was the right actions taken when something happened, for example, some crisis with the child's health. A parent may feel like that nobody really tried to do anything. But when you look at the procedure, you can see that everything was tried to be done and actually the child got help in the end. The experience may be totally different. And the parent's idea about they didn't try, they didn't do what they should have done, it's wrong. The professionals actually did everything they were able to. But of course, parents' experiences, still, it's real. And it tells something very, very important about the services as well. So this, how valid someone's knowledge or someone, the facts given by someone, it depends on the question. And even if informants' understanding about this, for example, this kind of procedure, it's wrong. It may be based on false ideas about what was expected to happen or misinterpreting the professional language or jargon, for example, that doctors have been telling. The parent may not understand and think that this nothing happened. Oh, this is just, he's just, you know, saying something to make me believe that that's all professional. I've heard these stories about just people talking about the same issue and not understanding a word what one is saying. And I don't know, Jukka, how much we have time. with. Okay, maybe I just. Okay, no. Okay, I start to just talk. I think we are not, it's not maybe good with this time to start to, especially here are quite small groups who could be done. So now these are more about these ethical questions, that what should I do if I just realize that informant does not know what he or she is talking about? What can I learn from her story? How to use such material in analysis? And of course, this is about, for example, this bad service experience. Was there really bad service? We can learn a lot from the stories of parents, even if they finally got the help. If they are so disappointed that they are... they are so disappointed, they feel like they have been just mistreated and everything was horrible and they have not been understood and heard at all. It can be said that it's bad service anyway. But when you ask from professional, they may say that, well, the child is alive. We were able to prevent this and this and this kind of things. The service was perfect. So bringing these different kind of understanding together It's sometimes quite difficult, I have found. How to be honest and how to say to my informants that, or how am I supposed to write these things so nobody will get hurt? Professionals are very, very eager to tell me that, yeah, parents don't understand. You can't say that there was a bad service when there was not. You are blaming us and you are just... making this conflict worse if you write something like that. So this is something I'm still working on because I still have, luckily I have time with my project that I can think how am I going to tell about these findings and my analysis and my outcomes to people. And then there is this question about these power relations and all categories. And I would really like to do what Laura said that we are able to do. So to try to open these categories and see what's there and then try to probably make them more... that they would illuminate the reality better. What is patient or client? What is their knowledge? But how to do that without becoming an advocate? That's one question. So this is, what should I do with these different ideas? I have to know what's good service. Is it that the child was saved from further disabilities, for example? That's, of course, that's the ultimate point. It's not good service if they are not doing everything they can to prevent further problems. But is it just good service? When you start to think what's good service from the viewpoint of these parents or clients, it's, of course, that to receive the help one needs in time. But also, it's about that you can feel respected and that your viewpoints we're taking seriously, and you are able to participate in negotiations, which are not so simple. As I said, these special needs, they are always different kind of combinations. They are not stable. The professionals from healthcare only see what's there in their office, and parents see the whole life of the child. Sometimes parents may have such information that's vital to be able to make these decisions, what kind of procedures are taking, what kind of medication, what to do. So if I would like to define what's good service from the viewpoint of the parents, there the client or patient is more or less collaborator. Of course,
he is also the one who needs help. But it's not so one-way relationship. So the one thing which has also become very clear with my data and these interviews with parents is that even if they have these false ideas, they may have misunderstood many things. If they do not know, if they do not understand that what they think, that this is a fact, I know this, I have read all these books, and then I can see or hear that, okay, no, that's not true, you have misunderstood it. First of all, should I tell them, I'm sorry, that's not correct. I've had this experience that I only afterwards, when I started to listen to interview, I realized that all these facts which were given so professionally to me, they were not correct. My informant had misunderstood many, many things. And I didn't know how to act. During the interview, of course, I didn't know it was false truth. But now I have been thinking that if that would happen again, the interview situation is like a discussion. I could say that, oh, I've heard differently. I would try to maybe change his ideas about the things. But of course, that's how much we can do that. Start to teach our informants what's real. In some cases, not at all. But in this case, I think that it would have been ethical to tell the person that you're not right, because those misunderstandings had led him to such actions which were not good for the child, because he was not getting help from the services. He had started to act as a doctor himself, and that's not a good case at all. So what if we want to make service system and services better? We can learn from these kind of viewpoints and even the falsities and false knowledge our informants have. That even if they speak something that professionals hear, that this is not true, oh, he's asking wrong things, we cannot offer that. If there is a real worry, and even if the jargon is not correct or information is not correct, good service should notice that there is a real worry there in that family. And that should be addressed. That should be somehow grasped. And then professionals could take over about the question that, well, what's there? What's really there? What is the real problem? So sometimes this problem that parents are not taking seriously and they do not possess right kind of knowledge or right kind of vocabulary or understanding, it may lead to that very, very serious situation where they are not getting help even if they are in need. So services shouldn't be there, of course, only for them, those clients who know what's the problem and they can tell that to doctors with right words. But they should be able to get help everyone who's in need of help, even that person comes from a very different kind of reality and with a very different kind of knowledge system and understanding. And I still have a few points I could go into a detail, but if you have any questions, I would love to answer. Or if you have any comments, or
any questions or comments?
Thank you. That was very interesting research that you've been doing, and what it reminds me of is the fact that this happens not only with children and parents, but with actual clients and patients themselves.
Yes.
Doctors very seldom listen to the people themselves.
Yes.
So this is a very, very general problem.
And yes, this is not, just my case.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But maybe not only with doctors even, but professionals in many other fields as well.
Yes.
Any other questions or comments? Actually, I would like to ask something.
Okay, thank you.
You said that you kind of have this aim that you want to change the situation.
Yes.
You want to sort of bring out the lay knowledge, you know, kind of maybe increase the value of the lay
yes.
knowledge
yes.
or the lay experience. Did you, when you were drafting your research plan, did you have to discuss this, you know, practical aim that you are doing something, you know, like you want to change the situation? Did you have to contemplate it before the project, or is that something that came up when you started working on your research, that you decided that this is something that you would like to do and, you know, try to change the situation if possible?
Well, in my project plan, which I sent to Academy, and they accepted it, so it wasn't all wrong, I wrote that there are serious challenges there. There are problems in collaborations, and children are not getting the best possible support. They have a right to, and they need, and they deserve. So I was open about this, and there is also I had a background literature to prove that there are these problems, especially in Finland, because of the nature of the system. So I was open about it, but I didn't write. I just wrote that I would like to come up with new knowledge, scientific knowledge that could be used someday to develop some practices. Then when I started this research, it went under the skin, and I became much more like, this has to be done, something has to be done. So it's, it was there, because I was able to show that there are problems, this research is needed, but I wasn't writing myself as a, like, some advocate for this. I was just the one who provides knowledge for someone else to develop. Now I am very, very happy that I am involved in these processes already. For example, with the teachers, those who answered my survey call, even without the film tickets. So, I can say a few words if you don't have questions, because Laura talked about this ethnographic data collecting, and I have, for example, used surveys and these questionnaires with open word possibilities. And so that's not ethnographic at all. But what I have been doing is that after I have analyzed it, I go there to meet the people from the city, the teachers from that city where I collected that data. And then we have discussion. And I have been giving such a good feedback and new ideas from those moments, and I am able to carry on my research much better than if I only had this questionnaire data. So it's not ethnographic, but it's like it's collaboration with your informants and co-creating the results and negotiating them. So I am not the one who says that these results show that. But it's just, it seems like this. How do you feel? And it has been very, very fruitful. And in case you are using questionnaires or surveys, I warmly recommend this kind of going there and meeting them and giving them the possibility to see if the questionnaires or that research results are good.
Have you already finished with your data collection? Are you doing any more?
No, it comes from different sources. This is also one thing that I wasn't able to. The field didn't open in a way that I would have wanted. And this happened in the beginning of the project. And then I started to network and find new kind of things. For example, in conferences, I actually met people who had similar ideas, and we were able to do some data collecting together. So this is one thing when you have open-ended project, that first you collect the data and then you say what you are able with that data. And when the field doesn't open or you get totally different kind of data that you planned, it's the situation lives all the time, let's say.
Okay, there was one question.
Yeah, thank you. I have a question in mind, but first some commentary. I'm from the field of psychiatry, and we have this joke that is only service that customer is always wrong.
Yes.
But I was thinking when you, in the field of psychiatry, maybe have done almost 100 years work to how to get customer into service more and how they can influence in their own treatment. But for example, when you are collecting some feedback, usually people only give negative feedback. Yeah. And I was also thinking that when you talk here, you were more concentrated on the negative side. Though I think it's difficult to get positive feedback. Those people never come back. They are happy somewhere else.
Yes.
But like here also, it would be important if you can get some positive feedback and compare those maybe to the negative.
Yes. Yes, this is... Okay, this was one problem-oriented presentation, I have to admit. If you want to develop something, you have to see what's the problem. But of course, what has been good, that shouldn't be changed, and it could also be developed further. So all the parents also gave me ideas what has been good, but mostly people want to talk about when somebody asks. It may be the first time somebody asks, how are you feeling? It has been very stressful period. Many, many years they have been under a huge stress, and then somebody asked that, oh, just tell me. And then they start, and it doesn't start. It starts with the sentence that, oh, everybody has been so good, and we are having good life now, and we have always received help. And then it starts, and it's all negative, because when life is online with certain informants, children are... the life is very difficult for the children and for the parents, of course, because they suffer for the child and they have to fight for everything. Then you are just so grateful when things are good and when things go on, and then crises happen, and then you just have to solve that. And they don't have time to come up with the narratives, maybe. And they stick to certain memories or points. And when asked, it's real that negative issues may come to mind. Then I have also read these narratives, which are, of course, very, very... They are written already. So they are very thought, and they are written in narrative form. And they are also very negative. I started from some idea, now I lost it. Maybe I think it should be really, it should be like a map of something or something like that. That what's good pathway, what kind of elements there are, and then a bad, something like that. You could start with that kind of mind map, maybe, and if I or anyone else really asked that, what was good? Tell me a good experience. Then we would get that kind of data also. But normally these discussions focus on the problems because the idea is that that's something we need to, bad practices, or we need to get rid of those. So you are right. It should be especially, the focus should be especially on good things.
Do you want to follow up on that? So, anyone else? Any questions? Comments? In case not, I think we will break for lunch now and continue at 12:30 then. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.